In the Edenverse, we're going to help you understand the Bible through the lens of the original audience. I'm Nathan.
And I'm Karen, and we hope you enjoy this episode.
Hey guys, today on the Eden Podcast, I am here with Kyle Keimer, who is kind of like, if you picture an Indiana Jones type figure who's like going around the world, solving all the problems of the world through archaeology, like that's basically who this dude is. And so my first question for you is, have you found the Holy Grail?
Well, I haven't. I'm here. So I haven't melted, so I must have chosen wisely. So.
That's awesome. I love it. Yeah. So, Kyle, tell us a little bit about yourself. What's your background, and how did you get to be the person that we're talking to about material culture?
Yeah. Well, a lot of Indiana Jones watching when I was younger.
Did you really?
Oh yeah. Yeah. That was awesome. One of the reasons I got into it.
Heck yeah.
Yeah, it was like, oh, this is fascinating. I want to go find things and blow things up. I mean,
I get to crack a whip and shoot some people? That's really, yeah, totally.
Of course, then there was a side of, you know, I love the Bible and found it fascinating, but, you know, it was mostly blowing stuff up, which all good archaeologists do.
Of course, yeah. Maybe a little bit more destructive than they should be sometimes, but it's all good, yeah.
Yeah, well, no. So, it was, in all seriousness, though, growing up watching Indiana Jones and then coupling that with just a fascination of the Bible was what led me ultimately into the field. And I started off down a different track, went on my first dig in my undergrad days, and just loved it. Yeah. Of course, it was at Caesarea Maritima, which is right on the Mediterranean.
Yeah.
You can't really
hard not to love that. Yeah.
And from there,
there's a lot of really cool stuff they've already done there. So,
oh yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure you walked in and just eyes wide open.
Yeah. It was fantastic. And it was my first dig, and we were actually excavating part of Herod the Great's temple there.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
And so, you know, it kind of sets things up for a great experience and, you know, came back, changed my major, continued on, did a PhD, went and lived in Israel for a little while, did some research there, and then ultimately was a professor of archaeology, history, languages of ancient Israel for several years in Australia, and then moved back to the U.S. and just really loved teaching about the Bible and bringing all that we know about the archaeology and all the great kind of material coming out of the academic world and bringing it to the people that really want to know it.
Yeah,
and I think there's a huge hunger for this, and particularly for good understanding of what does archaeology actually do, what can it inform us of, and how does that meet up with the text?
Yeah, totally. So when you lived in Israel, what did you work on?
The first time I was finishing my PhD and had a fellowship to do that at an archaeology institute in Jerusalem called the Albright Institute.
Nice.
And then kind of went back there for a second fellowship afterwards and did some more research that was based on historical geography and looking at the land, which I think is a really important aspect if we want to understand what's going on.
Yeah, totally. So did you dig in a certain spot? Have you focused on a certain time period? Like, what's your specialty?
Yeah, my specialty at this moment, or my interest in my research are the Iron Age. So early Iron Age. So we're looking at basically...
Yeah, nobody knows what that
is. I'm going to explain it. Okay, don't worry. I'm just getting there.
We were recording with Scott and Eric, and they're using all these words. Like, nobody knows what they're saying.
Yeah. No, I will explain it. So yeah, the Iron... So basically from around 1200 to about 900 BC.
Yeah.
Biblically speaking, this is the kind of the period of the judges in through the days of Saul, David, and Solomon. Mm-hmm. So this is my real focus in my research. As far as excavations go, I've been really fortunate to excavate at a number of sites throughout Israel, some in Cyprus as well. Everything from what we call early Bronze Age, so, you know, 3rd millennium BC, up through basically the British Mandate period, which is the early 20th century.
Yeah.
And so it's been a nice exposure across all different kind of material culture, different cultures, different time periods. So I feel extremely blessed to have been able to do all that.
That's awesome, man. I love it. Well, help our audience understand and help me understand, like, what is archaeology? What can it do? What can it not do?
Well, I think the easiest way to think about archaeology is that all it is really the studying of ancient cultures or people from the past and the material remains that they leave behind. Mm-hmm. No dinosaurs. No dinosaurs involved at all. All people.
Right? That's awesome.
And so...
But you have to have found like a T-Rex tooth or something along the way.
Yeah, the closest I think I've gotten, my oldest daughter found a shark tooth on the beach.
Oh, nice.
The other day.
Yeah.
Not in Israel, but in California.
In California,
but
yeah.
That's as close as I've gotten to any kind of, you know...
That's pretty close.
Big things, yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. So you're studying the actual physical remains that people leave behind, which are super informative, right? Like, what can it tell us about them?
Yeah. So it's great because, you know, one of the challenges we have with reconstructing history is we have texts for some cultures, right. But a lot of cultures we don't have texts for, a lot of periods we don't have texts. And so how do we reconstruct what was happening? Well, this is where the archaeology comes in, mm-hmm. and we have a larger sample with which to work in many cases, particularly in Israel, which is one of the most excavated countries in the entire world.
Yeah, right.
And so it's basically filling in the gaps where we don't have written resources. But at the same time, when we map it onto written resources, it kind of allows us to read between the lines and see what else is going on there.
Yep.
And it also changes the perspective that we're getting. Because most texts, I would say, are written by either the victors or the elite or people that know how to write, have the resources to write, whereas everybody's producing archaeological garbage, essentially.
Yeah.
And so that's what we're looking at, is everybody's garbage and trying to figure out, how is everybody else living and how does that relate to maybe what we see in the text?
Yeah, and the people who are writing the texts, it's not like they have a vested interest in exalting themselves.
Yeah.
So you're not getting an unbiased, a lot of times.
Yes.
I'm thinking about like the Sennacherib prism and stuff like that, where he just is totally,
Yes.
I destroyed all these people and I'm amazing. And
ancient kings are pretty well known for, being
fudging the facts a little bit. Like, I completely destroyed these people. And when you dig it up, you're like, this was kind of a tie.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. So what are some things that archaeology, where people overemphasize what it can do? Does that make sense?
Yes.
Like, what are its limitations?
Yeah. Well, I think the biggest thing, particularly when we're talking about the archaeology of ancient Israel or biblical archaeology, whatever we're going to call it, is that I think many people still think that archaeology can either prove, can prove the Bible.
Yeah, right.
Which is problematic because archaeology can't really prove it. Then there's a couple of reasons why this is a significant point to make out. It's because if you can prove it, then you can disprove it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing in the archaeology that disproves what we've found in the biblical text. But at the same time, it doesn't prove what the text is saying either.
Right.
And it's a matter of kind of different layers of the same cake. So the truth claims throughout much of the Bible aren't things that we can capture in the material culture.
Yeah.
We can corroborate and say, okay, well, these historical events took place. We might find destruction levels that we can possibly correlate. We find inscriptions that we can use to correlate to historic figures. But does that necessarily mean that everything took place the way the Bible says, or that some of these theological beliefs are accurate? Well, we can't go that far, and that's just the nature of the field. We can still do an awful lot with the archaeology and still helps us to greatly understand the text, the world of the text, and what people might have been kind of thinking and how they thought about it.
Yeah, totally. I find a lot of times, especially in my work as an anthropologist, that a lot of people are looking to archaeology to like, hey man, give us data points, give us that we can like throw at people. Mm-hmm. And I think the underlying issue there is like, hey, it feels almost like people are kind of like, we're not really sure if we can trust the Bible or not, so we kind of need you to like prove it for us. Mm-hmm. And what I'm hearing you say is, no, it's actually like, as you're reading the text, this can come along and supplement your reading of it to either help us read between the lines. In a lot of ways, I think it gives us a much fuller picture of what was actually going on than we would have if we just had the text. And so it feels like a supplementary coming alongside of not to prove or disprove, but to help us understand.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's one of the great kind of things that archaeology does, is that it comes alongside. And I'll give an example of how I think that it also helps us to understand and read the text better. And it kind of provides a corrective, if you will. Again, not proving or disproving, but allows us to read the text in a bit better way.
Yeah.
And actually, the example I'm going to give isn't really all that archaeological, but it's a really important fact.
It makes the point.
Of how to, that there's, I think there's a really important point, though, is that, regardless of what we find in the archaeology, we have to interpret it.
Yep.
Same thing with the biblical text. Regardless of what we're reading, we need to interpret it. So we don't just open up the Bible and say, oh, well, there we go. That's perfectly easy to understand by me, a 21st century person in a Western culture that no longer is an agrarian pastoralist who that, raises his own food. I mean, maybe some people out there do. I would say a large proportion of us do not do that.
Totally.
And so why is it that we assume that we just pick it up and understand everything, part of the worldview?
Yeah.
And the archaeology then helps us to correct that in instances, or to provide light by which we can better inform. And one instance is, I'm thinking of Joshua chapter 7, and there's the use of numbers in the biblical text. Yep. And one of the things that I love to tell students is that many times what we think of is, oh, that's a something of biblical proportions. Epic. It's biblical.
It's huge.
Well, biblical proportions are actually a lot smaller than what you think.
Totally.
And one of these, it comes down to how we understand the language.
Yeah.
And again, some of this is informed through archaeology by finding inscriptions that we can compare to other ancient cultures, which allow us a larger corpus of text by which to evaluate what words mean.
Yeah.
And in this case, it's the word thousand. So in Hebrew, it's aleph. And in most English translations, when it says a thousand, they just translate it as a number, 1,000. Yeah. But this term also means military unit or family unit.
Yep.
And in so when we look at the number of biblical texts, you know, we'll see numbers like 600,000 people or 200,000 individuals. In Joshua 7, it's 3,000 individuals that go up to battle against the site of Ai. Well, if you keep reading the text, right, you get this picture that 3,000 Israelites go up and fight against the Canaanites. They kill 36 people, and it's enough to send the Israelites fleeing away, and everyone's heart melts like wax or melts like water.
Yeah.
You say, well, wait a second.
That's 1%.
That's 36.
1% of the fighting force.
Out of 3,000, why then is a population of like 2 million people, if you're reading the numbers literally, going to melt like water?
Yeah.
Well, maybe we actually need to read the text a bit differently and recognize that this word has different meanings as well. And if we think of it as a military unit, you know, our best estimates are this is anywhere from 10 to 15 people.
Yeah.
Well, if we've got three military units instead of three thousands, maybe 45 people.
Yeah, 50 dudes.
Yeah, you lose 36
of them.
It's a
plussed up platoon.
Exactly. Yeah. You lose 36 of those individuals. Well, you've just lost three-quarters of your fighting force right there.
Mission incapable.
Exactly. Yeah. And so now, all of a sudden, the reaction that's captured in the biblical text makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, totally.
And we see this, again, throughout the text, that the numbers, if we allow for this kind of ambiguity, that it makes a lot more sense if we're reading as military unit or family unit, particularly in the context of how Israel was structured. Mm-hmm. And again, this is something that the archaeology helps us to inform, because we can look at their houses, we can look at how kind of space is used, and then we kind of bring that to the text as well and say, well, how were things structured? I mean, did people have giant families? Were they in households of 400 people? Were they, small nuclear families of three people? What does it look like? And how is that important for understanding the text? And it's a really important thing.
Yeah, totally. So I'm also thinking about some of the evidence that, correct me if I'm wrong, but that I've read about, that following the Exodus over the next period of however long, we do see like a population increase in Israel, but it's not near as biblical proportions. It's not like millions of people moved into Israel, although we do see an increase in population.
Yeah, and so one of the questions or issues is, when did the Exodus happen?
When did
the kind of Israelites come into the land? And then for some people, did it actually happen at all?
Yeah, right.
I'm of the belief that yes, it did happen. And when did it happen? Well, in the archaeology, we see that around 1200 BC, hundreds of new little villages pop up and little settlements pop up in the central hill country of Israel. This is where, according to the biblical text, the Israelites come and settle.
Yeah.
Well, here you have the archaeology that seems to match onto that. Is it millions of people, though? Well, no, we're looking at probably thousands of people, perhaps.
Right.
But at the same time, the archaeology is only a small portion of the picture, because we have to remember that Israel is a pastoral nomadic culture.
Yep, that's right.
And maybe not everybody settles down and starts building houses.
Totally.
You know, they don't walk into the land and be like, hey, Ted, let's, I know we've been pastoral nomads our entire life, but let's build a house today
and settle
down and never move again.
Yeah, right.
It doesn't happen quite so quickly. It's a process that takes time.
Yeah.
And so when we look at the archaeology, we don't have the full picture of the entire population that's there, unfortunately.
Yeah, totally. But it gives us a hint. It's like, okay, we see a slight increase. That doesn't prove or disprove anything. It's just an interesting corollary that's like, huh. It's another data point to help us go like, all right.
Yeah, exactly. And I think I think across the board, there's always many points like this that help us to understand the text better, and they give us good reason to say, hey, this text is recording things accurately. Provides a lot of good historic details, even though the main point of it isn't necessarily this is a history book.
Yeah.
You start and you just read and memorize all the dates. It's, you know, it's a theological history written in the terms of the day.
Yeah.
And we need to be able to accept that for what it is before we can ask questions. But at the same time, things match up. When you look at the archaeology, things match up over and over again. And so there's good reason to believe that, okay, this text is accurate, authoritative. It's not that we just read it and blindly believe whatever it says.
Yep. So I'm going to double click on the kind of biblical proportions. And I want to get into the way most people read the Bible, right? Where they'll open up a text. Now I'm thinking about the Jericho account, right? Same book, Joshua, where as a kid, I'm in vacation Bible school or Sunday school or something, and they talk about Jericho, and it's like they marched around the city, you know? And my thought was, well, dude, that would take a long time. Why? Because my idea of city is like this huge, just a huge piece of land that's like kind of 40, 50-foot walls. Like, I mean, these huge... Everything's enormous, population of a pretty significant size, and then you actually look at the excavation of Jericho, and you're like, what?
This isn't a city. What is this place?
Yeah, totally. But again, I think what I'm getting at is like help frame the actual world of the Bible for people. I know you mentioned earlier and you hinted at it, like, yeah, biblical proportions is actually pretty small. This is not we're not talking about like, you know, like massive empires that are going to battle here. These are smaller people that are skirmishing and trying to, you know, so anyway, yeah, go with that. Help us understand.
Yeah, I think it's a really good question point that with, say, Jericho or with any number of terms from the Bible, right? They have words that are contextually derived that have specific semantic ranges.
Yep.
They may translate into our language today, but the baggage that they carry is going to be very different. So when I say, hey, did you see that king over there?
Yeah.
What image pops to your mind?
I mean, yeah, like the British king or queen, royalty, big entourage, a spectacle, a parade.
Yeah. And I would say in every instance, this is not what we have in the ancient world. So it's important then to separate that and say, okay, here are our expectations as viewed across a larger historical period, and are those actually applicable to reading the biblical text? Now, the archaeology can help us because, again, we can look at the demography, like the number of people based on population estimates of the settlements we have, the size of those settlements, and we can say, well, this doesn't necessarily map onto how we might envision it in our world.
Right.
So we want to be really careful not to read into the text, but we want to be able to read out of it and allow it to speak on its own terms.
Yeah.
And, you know, whether we're talking about the city of Jericho, well, the word in Hebrew generally used for city is Ir, and that actually can refer to a settlement from basically a building to a metropolis, if you will.
Yeah.
And you have to know the context to know what it's actually referring to.
Right.
Same thing with king. Well, a king is anyone who has authority over an individual to many thousands of individuals. The text doesn't tell us.
Yeah.
And so we have to allow that, okay, when the Bible keeps talking about king this, king this, king this, these aren't giant royal people with, you know, giant entourages, but these are people with authority that other people listen to. Yeah. And how do you distinguish them from the others? Well, maybe you don't sometimes.
Yeah.
Maybe they don't have anything really distinguishing, but you know who that person is who has authority. Because the way that society is structured is all personal relationships in the biblical world.
Yep.
It's, you know, father to son, son to grandson, you know, elder to other elder. And it's not this massive bureaucracy where everything is depersonalized, but it's all a personal thing.
Yeah.
And the better way to think of it is, you know, in our world, we've got bureaucracies and we vote for people that we think are going to have the skills and ability to do a position. Whereas in ancient Israel, it's more like the Godfather. So Who's charismatic? Are they going to take care of the problem? Okay, great. Do I want to follow them? Well, they took care of my problem. Great. I'm going to follow them. Do they have their, did I vote for, I didn't vote for them, but you know,
but they took care of my problem.
But they took care of my problem. So I'm going to follow them.
Yeah.
And you know what? My sons, you guys listen to me because I'm your father. And that's the authority right there. And the whole way that you do life and society is very different than what we do today. And I think this is a really important point as we read the text to understand why things are happening the way they are and just the overall kind of social, political structuring of what's happening.
Yeah. I think about a couple of different things. I mean, my mind's going. For the audience, for, you know, a lot of you guys, if you listen to the equipping podcast, which I did prior, then, you know, I served in the military. And when I was in Afghanistan, like, this is how they function. Like, the Afghan tribes function like the biblical world. It's all relational. It's all, hey, this guy is the chieftain. There's no, and you really have no idea who that person is if you walk into a room. Or into, in that instance, like a compound courtyard, which is where a lot of these shuras and tribal meetings would happen. But you walk in and, I mean, everybody basically looks the same, but you can tell who the chieftain is by who everybody's deferring to and how they like position themselves and stuff. It's super interesting. And so when I was reading in Samuel where, you know, Saul is anointed the king, then you're... I'm like, oh, he's the king. And again, the kind of like, I think Sunday school VBS kind of thing is like, all right, that means he got coronated in front of this crowd and went, and now he's living up high on the hill in the palace and stuff like that. But in the text, it's like after he was crowned king, he went and then they found him plowing his field.
Just like kings do.
Yeah, it's like, why is the king plowing his field? Like, the kings don't do that. And that's where I think you see the tension points between our understanding of what was going on and what was actually going on. And and I mean obviously the point we're driving home is there's a pretty big difference there. And I think to be a good student of the scriptures, we have to re-envision how we think about the story given the land, given what we know about these people.
Yeah, exactly. And I'll come back to the Jericho example again because it's another thing. I think what you just said is the best thing because it is about our expectations of what we envision kind of in our mind's eye or what we're bringing to the text. And when we see Jericho as a city, well, maybe we think it has a giant fortification wall, freestanding city wall that's 40 feet tall. And well, when we look at the archaeology, we find that in what we call the Late Bronze Age, so this is basically 1500 to about 1200 BC, that cities that are quote-unquote fortified really are basically houses built around the edge of the site, one next to another.
Yep.
And they don't have big, giant freestanding walls.
Yep.
That's something that took place earlier when there were bigger cultures, and it takes place later on, but not in this time period, which actually is helpful because when we look at the whole Jericho narrative, actually we go back to Joshua 2 when the spies go visit Rahab. Mm-hmm. There's this passage that says Rahab lived in the wall, and she let the spies out the window in her house, which was built into the wall. And scholars for the longest time are like, well, what does this mean? It makes no sense. Mm-hmm. Why is her house built into the wall? Mm-hmm. It's got to be some late addition or, you know, something else. But when you look at the archaeology, well, you know, what it's saying is that basically the houses are built, and that is the city wall. The backside of your house, built one next to another in a circle, is the city wall, and there's a window in it because it's the wall of your house.
Yeah, yeah.
And
you got to be able to look out.
You be able to look out it. The interesting thing is when you look at Egyptian reliefs, like stone reliefs that depict all these scenes from roughly that time period, you see pictures of cities in Canaan that have little rectangles in the walls.
Hmm.
Well, are these windows? I mean, it's a good possibility that that's what they're depicting, is that these are windows in the city walls because, again, the houses are built in a circle.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, the archaeology informs the reading of the biblical text and actually solves a historical issue of what in the world is going on. And at the same time, it changes our expectations of what we might be envisioning and what we think is going on.
For sure.
Because here we don't have this huge, huge site of Jericho. It's a smallish site that, you know, a few acres in size that has, you know, a row of houses built around it, and the spies come in to visit. Now, it talks about a king of Jericho. They still have a king. There's still a guy who's in charge of everything, even if it's only, you know, a few hundred people. The magnitude of it doesn't really impact the miraculous or the theological point. It's just, okay, now we have it in biblical proportions as illustrated from the archaeology.
And it's a lot smaller than you thought it was.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I want to go back a little bit to one of the things you said earlier where you were talking about the importance of the land. So, you know, obviously the land is there, you're pulling material things out of it. But in a lot of ways, when you're reading the biblical narrative, like the land is an actual character in the story because it shapes like how things happen, where things happen. When you read things in the scriptures where you're like, man, that just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. And then you go see it where it happened, you're like, oh. So like, talk to us about the importance of understanding the actual land and what that can do for our reading of the scriptures.
Yeah, well, the land, I would say, is like the glue that holds everything together. And it's the foundation, literally the foundation upon which all the events of history and then the theological implications of those events takes place. And so if you don't know anything about the lay of the land, you're really kind of floating around in the air, not having a foundation.
Well, you're filling in a bunch of empty space with your own imagination, which doesn't correlate to what's actually real.
Exactly. Exactly. And so when you have a great understanding of the land, like you said, it's one thing to read the text and to come to a list of city names or people name and be like, oh, I'm just going to skip that because I don't know how to pronounce them and who cares and blah, blah, blah.
It's kind of boring. Well, Lord, why did you include this? Can you please speed it up a little bit?
I think it's because he loves geography. That's why. But it's very important, right? Because when you know where these places are and how, I mean, the land isn't flat. And this is one perception I think a lot of people unfortunately have because Hollywood presents it this way, is it's either this flat, desert-like terrain that everything's dry. No. Most of Israel in particular is not like that. Yeah, you've got some territory like that, but a large portion of it gets a lot of rainfall, has streams, water, lots of things. I mean, it's a land of milk and honey. The text tells us it's a prosperous land, and it's a very rugged land as well. Mm-hmm. And so when you understand the lay of it and how different settlements pop up in different places, well, how do the people, those settlements relate? How then do the events of history unfold? I mean, everything starts with an understanding of the land. And of course, then it fills in when we're reading the text of how is the land functioning for the biblical author or authors? Because they will make allusions to this or that feature or location. And if you know what they're alluding to, now I get what they're trying to say.
Yeah. All of that empty space starts to be filled in with the proper, or at least closer to the proper information. One of the things I find really interesting is the more you understand the actual land, it's not just helping your understanding of how the biblical narrative plays out. It definitely does that. And people should, you know, pay attention to that. Like your study Bible that has maps in it and stuff, like they're there for a reason.
Yes.
Like that's like the thing that falls out the first and people are like, yeah, whatever, you know? And it's like, no, time out. Like the drama of the biblical narrative plays out on a set. Mm-hmm. And if you remove the set, then what? No. All right. So anyway, there's a little soapbox there, but it also tells us something, you know, because you mentioned the names listed there before, where it's like, hey, why are they there? You know, why does it talk about, why does it spend such a long time like talking about the division of the land and which family settled where? And I mean, those are like really, really critical pieces if you understand the importance of the land. Mm-hmm. And so I think too, when, you know, one, I just wanted to hammer that point home. But then also talking about names. A lot of times, you know, you read through these lists and you're like, man, how in the world do we know any of these things? But actually, the discipline of archaeology can help us because, I mean, people kept records, right? And so talk to us about how archaeology can help us fill in some of those gaps.
Yeah, well, I think there's two points that I would make with that. And why are the names there? Well, I think one really important thing that we get from reading those in the text is that it highlights how ancient Israel conceptualized of society. Mm-hmm. It's a communal society. The idea of the individual, individualism, doesn't exist.
Yep.
It's not a thing. Who am I? I'm the author of this. No. You're a community. You're part of a family. You're usually identified either by the location where you live, by who your father is, or by your kind of tribal clan affiliation as well. And it highlights, again, all these names are showing there's a cohesive unit that exists, and this is what God envisions for Israel. We don't want to leave anyone behind.
Yeah.
So how do you do that? You know how everybody's related to ensure that people don't fall behind, that people aren't excluded from the group, and it helps to make society work.
Yeah.
Now, the interesting thing then in the archaeology is we have several inscriptions that have biblical names. One of the most famous cases of inscriptions are called the Samaria Ostraca. So these are basically little pieces of pottery that have writing on them that were discovered at the site of Samaria. And they list a bunch of different names we know from the book of Numbers, different tribes. Basically, these are the tribes of the daughters of Zelophehad. And so we know that these names match up, and it's referring to the social relations of how they connect with each other, but more so how they relate to the Israelite kingdom or the Israelite royal household at that time period. The other important thing that we get from the names and why they're there, I think, is because all names have meaning in the ancient world. I mean, this is something I think we lose track of in modern times. But names always have meaning. So Hezekiah, right? Well, the God Yahweh is my strength, is basically what his name means. And so you learn a lot about where people come from, what their beliefs are, who they're related to, just based on their name. The whole study of ancient names is something called onomastics. And it's really important because you not only can learn the things I just mentioned, but it also allows you in many cases to pinpoint a historical point for when a specific kind of name is being used.
Yeah.
So I'll give you an example. So at the site where I've been kind of co-directing excavations, a site called Kibbutz Arai, we found an inscription from around 1100 BC that mentions the name Jerubbaal. So if any of the listeners out there know the biblical text, this is the other name of Gideon in the book of Judges, right? Jerubbaal. Well, is this actually a reference to Gideon of the Bible? Well, no. Yeah, highly unlikely. Yeah, yeah. It's not. It's in the wrong geographic location.
Well, that, and it's not like he was the only one called Gideon or Jerubbaal.
Exactly. Yeah. But the important thing, though, is that here's a name that we can pinpoint archaeologically to around 1100 BC. Mm-hmm. We know that it's a name, that structure of a name, you know, Jerubbaal, the name, the god Baal is in there. Mm-hmm. These kind of names don't occur necessarily far earlier than that period, and they don't occur far later in that period. Yeah. And so when we look at the story of Gideon, it's set in the biblical chronology in this time period, roughly 1200, 1100 BC. Yep. Archaeologically, now we have an inscription that says, here's that kind of name that was used in that time period. It matches up. It doesn't prove the Bible, but it says, hey, there's a historical memory here, if nothing else, in the book of Judges that puts these people in this time period and paints a picture of what society was like at that time period. Yeah. You look at names later on, David, Solomon, well, those are different types of name from Jerubbaal. Hezekiah, now all of a sudden everybody uses the name Yahweh instead of Baal. Isaiah, right? Well, that's a bad example. I just made that up. So Yeshayahu means salvation, but I couldn't think of a good one off the top of my head.
So I just started making crap up.
You get the point, awesome, though, right? So names have meanings, and they tell us a lot about the society, but they also allow us to pinpoint within a broad range where certain events or peoples should be located.
Yeah, that's really cool, man. Yeah, I mean, dude, it's so fascinating to, you know, as we, because archaeology as a formal discipline isn't that old. Goes, I mean, what, 150, 200 years, something like that? And yet, like this, the work that's being done to help give us a much fuller picture of the world that they lived in, what was life like, all the way down to, like, you know, what did they eat? What kind of fashion did they have? What do they care about? Like, what you can, you know, you can gain a lot more information from, you know, just pulling junk out of the dirt and looking at it, studying it. It is fascinating, even though it doesn't, like we've made the point, like, don't think that it's going to prove or disprove the Bible, but it's so fascinating that it's not like a piece of information has come along that's created this massive, like, we just have, this is a very difficult thing for us to reconcile with the text, you know? And, so where I want to end is, what are just some of your main lessons learned as an archaeologist, from the little boy watching Indiana Jones, you know, to where you are now? What are some of the major things, if, just for you personally, to go, man, this has impacted me in significant ways?
Yeah. Well, before I say that, I'm going to go back to the Yeshayahu thing. Yes, that was actually right. I was thinking too fast and got flustered, so I'm going to stand by what I said initially. So we don't have to cut that out or anything. Now, to me,
it's awesome when you correct yourself and then you realize I didn't need to correct myself because I'm right. It's awesome. All right, personal takeaways.
I think one of the most important things is that I've learned that asking questions about the biblical text is okay.
Yeah, that's good.
And we don't need to be afraid of anything that's out there. Mm-hmm. I mean, the text is going to stand. It's been there for thousands of years. And if it is the Word of God, it's going to continue to stand. There's nothing that we're going to find that's going to change that. There's nothing that we're going to find that's going to there's nothing we need to find to prove that either.
Yep.
And I think in the archaeological record, again, as I mentioned, we have all this material that really says, hey, everything kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
It fits.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there's no smoking gun that says, right, this is absolutely 100% what it means, and it definitely does this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think this, you know, if we're thinking highbrow theology here, I think this is actually very purposeful, because, you know, what does God call us to many times in the text? Well, there's got to be a level of faith there. And so what if all of a sudden we found the Ark of the Covenant? Okay, maybe we will someday, and if it exists anymore, what's that going to do? Is it going to make some people believe now that the biblical texts are accurate, mm-hmm, and that God is who he says he is, and right, Jesus is who he says he is? Or is it just going to be, you know, maybe some people will, some people won't?
Well, Jesus showed up, and when he showed up, they didn't believe him.
Yeah, exactly. So,
it's kind of like, what do you think the Ark of the Covenant's going to do? Right? God himself showed up, and they didn't believe him. Yeah.
So I think that's the important thing, is it's okay to ask questions. But it's also okay if we don't have nice, neat answers.
Yeah,
because cool. We're not always going to get a smoking gun answer, and sometimes we have to be okay with that. Even in the days of Jesus, they're interpreting the Old Testament from, you know, hundreds of years earlier, and they don't always understand it. They don't, mm-hmm, always have all the answers, but that's okay. It's, you know, where is your faith? Where is your understanding? What is your relationship with God and others? I mean, I think there are certain truths that can be drawn out no matter how we grapple with the text,
yeah,
and good, whether or not we have all the answers.
Yeah, I think one of the necessary things for a good student of the Scriptures is just to hold in tension what are essentials, right? So, like, you know, if all of a sudden we found beyond the shadow of a doubt, like, the bones of Jesus, mm-hmm, and, you know, stuff like that, where it's like, that's going to affect, you know, our belief system. So, like, we hold certain things to be essentials. And then what are things you just have convictions about? And then what are some, mm-hmm, opinions? And what are, and I think we have to hold a necessary, healthy tension about, hey, I'm looking at this a certain way, but the way I'm looking at it, while it has validity to it, is not infallible. It needs to be able to shift and change, mm-hmm, and go, hey, maybe I wasn't looking at this completely accurately. In fact, I know I wasn't. But so a lot of people do feel that way. And it's like, hey, no, hold it loosely. Allow, as we gain more information, allow the information to help you gain a healthier picture of it. And sometimes that means you're going to change your opinions. You're going to go, oh, it wasn't 6 million people. It was 600 family units, or 600,000 people. It was 600 family units. It's like, oh, well, that's way different. It's like, okay. Like, not essential.
Yeah.
In fact, now I'm grateful now that I have that piece of information, because now my view of the text is going to be more accurate than it was before. And I would just say for our audience, man, that's a really critical point that I think you're driving home there.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you say it really well, is that there has to be the ability to change how we understand things,
yep,
because we don't always know the answers. And a lot of what we believe, particularly as Christians, has come from tradition and previous interpretation.
Yep.
But you know what? They had to interpret the
they
text
totally
as well.
Yep.
How does that relate to the earlier tradition?
Yep.
Well, they probably had to either build on that or change how they interpreted it as well.
Yep.
And so it's always a thing that's fluid in motion. And the nice thing with archaeology is we're always getting more material,
yep,
which should cause us to pause and reflect and,
yep,
to reevaluate how we view things, how we interpret things, and, yep, say, okay, maybe I need to step back and look at this a different way. Yeah. And maybe what I've thought isn't actually the best way, or maybe not the only way that we can read this.
I think a good way to think about it is, it's not that more information invalidates the text. It's that more information helps us to see the text for what it actually is.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to
say it. So a lot of times people are like, well, are you saying you don't believe the Bible? And I'm like, no, I do believe the Bible. I just believe it as it is. And I'm certain that the way that I'm viewing it is not a one-to-one. I'm not viewing it perfectly. And so as I get more information, I'm able to see it for what it actually is instead of what I'm trying to make it. So I love it, man. Well, hey, dude, thanks for jumping in the studio with us today.
My pleasure.
It was a lot of fun just chatting with you. And I would just encourage the audience, like, for you guys, as we're talking about the world of the ancient Near East, hopefully something that was said today would pique your interest. And just to help you understand, too, as we're going through this world, like, we really are trying to help you get into it. Because where we're going from here is going to be really cool as we talk about the theological implications of seeing the world of the Bible and reading the scriptures through that new lens. Those theological implications are going to be really significant. Primarily, the fact that we'll see that what we see in Yahweh is a God who loves, and He loves you. So until next time, you guys have a good one. Peace.
You've been listening to Edenverse. If you like what you heard, subscribe, tell your friends, give us a rating. If you have questions, email us at podcast@edenteam.org. If you want to know more about our organization, visit our website at theedenproject.com. Lastly, check out all of our other podcasts. Thanks for spending part of your day with us, and remember, God loves you. Bye.
Peace.